This is the story of the one. Who, as a maintenance specialist for a historic high-rise, knows that vintage charm historically needs constant attention. Which is why, when it's time to upgrade turn-of-the-century mechanicals, they turn to Grainger. With easy access to a million-plus products and the scale to deliver when and where you need them, the right tools and supplies are never far away. So the one can keep that vintage building running like new. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to another BritFlix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and on today's show is Jonathan Eckersley, writer-director of The Stoic. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Stuart. Thank you for having me on. Very flattered. Been following you for a while.
We're here to talk about your feature film debut, The Stoic, and we're going to talk about three films that have impacted everything in adult life after that. So, without further ado, first off, when can people see The Stoic in the UK?
In the UK, it is going to be released on the 4th of November. So that's, it's going to be DVD, you can buy it in Asda, HMV, I believe. And you can order it now, pre-order it on Amazon. And it's going to be streaming. I think it's going to be streaming Amazon as well. But essentially, my friend, 4th of November. It's a great boon for us. It's actually physically produced on DVD, which is a rare thing.
So, to get people interested then, do you want to give us a brief synopsis to what The Stoic is about?
Certainly. So, it's what actually happens. You basically start with a gang of mercenaries who have just done a drug raid on a house. It's contemporary. They run off to a country retreat. And what's happened with this house, which we don't see, it's off stage, is that essentially they had to pick up two women who were kept as drug mules by this gang. Mm-hmm. Okay. So they bring them with them to this country retreat. The women try to escape. They run after them. And in this particular act of firing their gun in a field and bringing the women back to captivity on this country estate, they are noticed by the Stoic, who is a man from a clan of Stoics, ancient smugglers. They have their own morality system, 17th century psychopaths, as Jason Fleming describes them in the film. And this particular Stoic, Aurelius, they're not the Stoics in the way you might think of Greek/Roman classical figures.
Okay.
Or Marcus Aurelius himself. They are from the more Amish than anything else, to be perfectly honest, in a way. But they live a reclusive life. Again, they have a history of sea smuggling. Well, they won't smuggle people. That is a hugely offensive thing. And the Western world's idea that we all have roofs, we all have heating, well, some of us do, and access to food. The fact, though, that we still step on each other like food isn't available and we all backknife each other is a hugely offensive thing to the Stoics. So the fact that he sees two women being taken by these men is hugely offensive and used as commodities. And the female characters themselves, certainly what the lead, Jane, interesting character. I did some work with the homeless and I heard a story of, but a woman told me this true story of how she was passed from Manchester gang to gang, you know, as, forgive me, but, you know, as a toy, as a mule, taking fuel, drugs from house to house or to buyers, what have you, and live rough. And I based that experience of that person I met on, I gave it to this character, not literally word for word the same story, but it was that experience.
Got you.
Okay. So I'm quite proud of the fact that the characters in this film all have a grounding. So the gang of mercenaries are not these diehard two mercenaries. They're like three or four of them are dishonorably discharged. The rest are actual suburban or mercenaries who could go and fight abroad or what have you. But what they do is they perform criminal acts, and certainly the ones who are dishonorably discharged, when they're not doing that, when they're not part of gangs, they're on the dole. They'll climb. So they're not these ex-Green Berets, you know. They're blokes in the street, you know. Yeah. And they have their own backstories and selfish attitudes, and each one is invested at a different level, either running away because they want to, because they're trapped by the Stoic. They're trapped by Mr. Rhodes, who tells them to stay put, who's there, the guy who employed them, who's coming in to see them, because he's obsessed with the Stoics. He's had a brush in the past and he wants to see the Aurelius. Mm. And that character, Rhodes, is brilliantly, I think he's brilliantly played, and I'm biased, by Bruce Payne, who you may, a lot of people may remember from as the bad guy in Passenger 57.
Okay, okay.
With Wesley Snipes. But he's done the Dungeons and Dragons franchise and dozens of films since. But that was a standout thing for him. And he and Jason Fleming agreed to appear in the film, which we're very pleased about. We've got Scott Wright, who's also co-producer, playing the Stoic. And he did a great job. He did a great job.
Him playing the Stoic, which is obviously the titular character to the film, yeah. Casting him must have been really important. And given he's also the producer, obviously he got involved with it more than your average actor would have done, I suppose. So how did he come to be in the role of the Stoic then? I'm guessing it wasn't a usual kind of audition thing, was it?
No, well, Scott and I have known each other for 4 or 5 years. We met when I was directing a corporate video, and he was the presenter on it.
Okay, you know? Okay.
And it was kind of like, I want to make a film. Yes, so do I. We talked now and again. We did a few other jobs together. And, I've got a rental property. I'm lucky to have one because I'm from that generation. But some tenants trashed, and it helped me in the back end of the pandemic kind of fix it up again, you know, so we talk more. And in the pandemic, I wrote The Lineman, which is the Stoic's relationship with his daughter, mm-hmm. which I think is one of the best things I've ever written. We couldn't raise the money to make that. However, we made this prequel where I said, look, if we raise X amount, I can write something that fits the budget, mm-hmm. that fits one location. Three locations in the end, but essentially 85% one location. And we can make it work, and it will be based on, guess what? Character and story, because they're free. And you don't have to pay to blow anything up. You don't have to hire character and story. You know, they're essentially, if you get actors who can invest, you have a story that's going to compel the audience, a character that can compel the audience, they are essentially, you cannot invoice for that. No. Nobody can invoice you, you know? So that's what we did. And I hope, I mean, the audience will be the judge, not me, but I hope that they do find this compelling. They do enjoy the characters. And opposite to Scott, you have Rocky Boy Williams. And Rocky's a really interesting character. He's a former, well, he still is, but, you know, professional MMA fighter down in London. He's from really interesting traveler heritage himself. He was in, is it London Has Fallen, where Gerard Butler has a fight with like special forces guy?
I think so, yeah.
That's Rocky.
Oh, wow.
And he comes out and he verbally lays into Butler. Mm. And they have a go back at each other. That's Rocky. He's done all these small parts in all these big films, but he's now got, along with Scott's character, a complete character arc.
Yeah.
The Stoic's the Terminator. He's like this thing that's just going to keep coming at you.
I was going to say, okay? Let's rewind a second then. So the Stoic seems like you've got yourself a concept, or a high concept at that. So where does that idea of the Stoic come from when, in terms of you beginning to write a screenplay that becomes the film The Stoic?
It comes from, my dad mentioned the Stoics growing up. My dad is a painter. He was a plasterer for 20 years, went to training with lads, and he's retired now. But he used to mention Stoicism and the Stoics when I was growing up. And I can play back the recording of the way he used to intonate and speak about them briefly, lecture me on it. And then I remember I jumped out of a perfectly good aircraft in 2004 and smashed several vertebrae. So I was laid up in a spinal unit for several months. Oh, yeah. And my dad came in and went, there's a book on Stoicism. And I went, oh, thanks. Great. That's you know, it's my family. Which was, you know, don't moan.
Yeah.
Deal with it.
Take Northern to another level.
Yeah, it's taking Northern to the... So I was kind of, yeah, okay. And I get it. And Stoicism is about, it's not about being hard as nails all the time. It's about keeping that mid-frequency where you're not too excited, you're not too depressed. As Seneca said, a famous Stoic, you know, we suffer more in our imaginations than we do in reality, i.e. we dwell on what might be, on the negatives, and in fact, they don't always come to pass, but we suffer in our minds on them, we dwell in our minds on them. But I took this idea of Stoicism and kind of wove it with this almost Amish witness-type cult. Not calling the Amish a cult, I'm just saying it is a cult in
yeah,
the Stoic
film. Yeah. In simplistic terms, yeah.
Took the two cultures and attitudes. And again, you know, they talk, the Stoic has a guy bound up and he's about to kill him, or is he? And he says, this guy's trying to plead for his life, and he's got, oh, you Westerners. It's the way you lie and you flatter and you deceive and the whole thing. And it's all about you and what's offended you today. And it's all the ego. And so there's that philosophy in it, there's that social attitude, mm-hmm. which lends itself to his contempt for the mercenaries, which lends itself to Rocky Boy Williams' character arc, going from the head of the mercenaries to what he develops to in the film.
Okay.
And Scott's character, Aurelius the Stoic, as well, has regrets. He could have saved a child, and it's how he psychologically deals with that as well, which comes out. And the women in the film, they become kind of... they're Stoics themselves. They're the ones who really just suffer at the hands of all these idiots, you know?
Yeah.
So, and they're consistent towards the end, and they have some interesting twists and turns. So it's a philosophy that was kind of imparted upon me in my childhood. Now, with social media or the film Gladiator, the whole thing's become much more popular now.
Mm.
You know, and this Stoic Week in America, which coincidentally is about this time of year, in 2023, was next week, I think. So there's a lot going on, and there's a lot of people podcast on it and what have you. Holiday is a big one in America. And I think there's an awareness of it enough now, you know.
Yeah.
And I wrote the script. I wrote it in a month, wrote a second draft in a couple of weeks, came together, gave it to Neil Jones, who is a producer and director. He's been on this show, but a prolific producer. I first did films for him for, you know, general release and for Sky Cinema and Amazon and feature films. And he read my script. He liked it. He came in as an exec. Jennifer Chippendale came as a producer. Scott Wright's dad, Terry Wright, came in as a producer as well. Well retired and not in the film industry at all, but he came in on the business side of things, which was useful. And we essentially got a great crew together of first-hand guys and older men and women who are very experienced, heads of department, great cast. And what I did with the cast was, I didn't go, right, let's workshop the heck out of this, and let's really knead the dough, and let's have read-throughs. No, none of that. Not interested, right? What I want to do is this. I'm going to treat you as adults. I mean, not that actors aren't adults. They're all experienced. That actors to one extent or the other. I'm going to talk to you about your life experience, and I don't know how that pertains to your character. And then you go away, and based on the brief I've given you, where the story's going, what your character does within the story, you write your character, come back to me, we'll consult. Okay?
Oh, wow.
No big surprises on set, and we'll talk. So it was interesting the way, you know, I did that with Scott, and he had a few ideas, and what about the accent? I said, well, why don't you try like a Mads Mikkelsen type, because these are Scottish / over to Norway and Scandinavia, what have you type. Heritage in the Stoics, try that. And he came out with something really interesting. And Rocky, they call them the men in bonnets, the Stoics. They wear these bonnets, which are the hallowed, like berets in the army. I never thought of it a bit like that. And Rocky Boy Williams, it's this scene where he has to think and he has to hold the bonnet and think about it. And he said, what's this bonnet like? And I went, well, Rocky, it's like it's got some frills on it. And he went, it's like a beret. And I was like, yes, got you, done. He knew how to approach that prop in that film.
Okay.
And Rocky, I spoke to all the cast, spoke to 2-3 times a week. Scott and I didn't meet that talk that much in pre-production because we've been talking for 4 years.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That was a longer relationship. But I just basically let the cast. And, you know, George McCluskey was interesting. Stu Brennan, Gerald Benjamin, they all had some interesting takes on the Mushy Noor. They all had some interesting takes on their characters. And I said, you know, with George McCluskey, he called me up one day and he went, this character, he went, is this petulant officer? And he said, he's a baby. And I went, yeah, he's a baby. Actually, you said it really well. You know, he's this petulant guy and he's got friction with Rocky, et cetera, et cetera. So go with that. Go with that petulance. And I worked with a really interesting Kenny Glenarn, Glaswegian director, and BAFTA nominated, or he was a winner, Kenny, him and Gillis McKinnon, another Glaswegian, actually. Two really interesting directors, and they both come from a similar practical, really effective way of dealing with actors.
Yeah.
But I remember Kenny saying to me once, we did an episode of DCI Banks together,
mm-hmm.
and he said, this episode, John, I'm not going to do the Glaswegian accent, but this, because I can't, this episode is about, and I can't remember what it was like, it's about regret. Mm. It was a thing. And every scene and every line, and obviously not literally every line, so much so would be nailed to that theme. And that's the key, and that's the way we're going to crack through this episode. That's the way I saw it. And I thought, that's interesting, because you can apply it to film more than TV.
Of course.
And I've done this when directing shorts or anything. It's like, people go, what do we do? I went, right, what's the scene about? What's actually happening in the scene? Not, well, I come in, I do this. No, not you come in. What's it about?
Mm.
What are you taking the audience through? You know? And I think in The Stoic, it's a folk thriller. And a lot stuck to that theme. So we've got the atmosphere of the woods, the screaming foxes, wolves. I know there's no wolves in Britain, but there is in Europe. Bear with me. Owls. Everything's by campfire and candles at night. Everything's the cold, stark day of day. That helps in the colour grade, which is like, I want stark days and warm nights, you know? The first week we had to avoid shooting the snow because North Wales, it was just snowy everywhere. It wasn't going to last. I'm particularly proud of the fact we've got Russian spoken in the film, got Polish twice, two scenes. We've got Scottish Gaelic spoken, which was interesting because I found a Scottish Gaelic society on Facebook.
Yeah.
And then through that, a gentleman who was in his 70s and I think he was a retired school teacher. I'm still in contact with him. But he spoke Scottish Gaelic till he was 7 years old. So I think that was like into the 50s, 60s. Right. That's all he spoke. He learned English, you know, when he was like eight, he told me.
Bloody hell.
But he, and I said, look, do you want a credit? Do you want this? Do you want that? You know, and he just went, just get it right. Just get the language right. And I went, done. Yeah. You know, thank you so much.
You said at the beginning that when you wrote this film, it was for 85% of the going to be a single location with a couple of other locations thrown in. So when you're talking to your cinematographer, Gary Rogers, what are you saying? What's the conversation about in terms of what you want to achieve and how you make it interesting when you haven't got a lot of locations to deal with?
Well, my conversation with Gary, we turned up and we did a recce, so we did a lighting test where I'd say, look, this is a typical interior and these are two key scenes. One's in the stables where the girls are kept, and one was across this huge, polished, beautiful table with Bruce Payne and Rocky and George McCluskey. And I said, look, let's light these because these are the most distinct lighting setups we're going to have in the film and the most difficult. Let's try and light them. Let's light them the way I think they should be lit. See what you think. And that's what we did on a test. So that was the conversation.
Okay.
Rather than sitting down and getting academic about it, it was like, okay, let's just take a couple of redheads, a couple of Mizars, and some candles and some reflector boards, and let's just do this, you know. And some mist, some smoke, you know. So that was the conversation for the look of it. And that's how I say we found the look. We always knew what it was going to be, but we found how to create it. But I think when you've got one location which is stunning, it's this 17th, 16th century yard, beautiful house, $5,000 flipping weekend Airbnb.
Okay,
the crew all stayed in, very little because we had a relationship with the owner and she allowed us to shoot outside. And it was so interesting with the stables and everything. It was all, I had to get it surveyed safety-wise, you know, risk assessed, and insured.
Okay.
Sorry?
I said, okay. No, I didn't realise you would have to go to that trouble.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm a first AD, so it's kind of like, you know, oh, my God, we've got to get insured. You know, it's just my thing.
Got you.
So part of my kind of toolkit, really. And then once you've got it, like, you can relax and get on with it. But there's so many nooks and crannies and ways of shooting things, you know. And I've firsted films or made films where I've said, look, we're in this corridor, but if you just turn the camera the other way, that's a whole different set. The audience won't know that's somewhere else. You know, and if we just come over here and just light that background and silhouette that person, that's a whole different set almost. I mean, Alien was made with just a Alien 1, just a T-junction of corridors, but the way Ridley Scott shot this way and that way with different lenses, and then, all right, we've shot it out, so let's spray it all black and it looks like a different tunnel. I just don't know. So that's the way I exploited the location we had. But luckily, we had so many nooks and crannies. It was great, you know. And I'm experienced enough, particularly through directing like historic documentary series I once did for Channel 4, to be able to bounce around very quickly and go, next shot's here, next shot's there, bang, 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 bang. So that's how we shot it in 17 days, really 15. It was shortish days, 15 full days. But people say, how did you shoot that in 15 days? Well, it was planned properly. We knew our resources. We effectively used their resources. That includes the cast.
Yeah.
You know, Scott was on board with that. The whole Neil Jones was, Jennifer. Everyone understood what we were trying to do with the resources we had.
Yeah.
So, and we just go into it. I go, we're doing three big scenes today. We've got 3 hours per scene. Let's do it. You know, and while we're here, let's shoot a little vignette of this guy going off his head on his own. Let's spend 10 minutes on it. And you can get an incredible amount of footage just doing that.
Yeah.
And we just found solutions on the day when we went through it. I mean, you can storyboard it, but it just becomes very dull and dictatorial, because you end up with storyboarding. It's useful if you're communicating something, if you've got to weave in visual effects or post-production effects. People need to know what they're paying for at the end of the day. They need to know what that shot's going to cost.
Yeah.
But if it's just, you know, a smallish unit, medium-sized unit, and X amount of actors who just want to get on with it, then you've got more freedom on the day. And we found shots on the day. And
can you give an example of a shot that you didn't plan for that you found on the day?
Yeah.
That
could... Yeah, I can.
Please do.
There's a shot, the girls are in foreground lying in a room.
Yeah.
And there's a door, right? And this wasn't in the script, but I wrote it because of the location.
Yeah.
And I didn't, the action I wrote, it's on a first floor. So if you open this single door and step out, you will fall 10 feet onto stone.
Wow.
This old stable.
Okay.
Right. It'll ruin your day. So, but what I wanted to do was, I was driving from my hotel. So, you know, the crew are in this gorgeous big, I'm in this drafty motel down the road. There's this gorgeous big palatial house. But you've got to look after these people. So basically, and they work incredible, all of them. I was like, right, how do I shoot the stoic climbing up the wall outside without actually seeing him climbing up the wall outside? Because it's a stunt. We don't have that kind of stunt budget. And I went, right, here's what we do. You hold on the girls in foreground. Don't light them. Just use available light. Just kiss them a little bit from the window. And there's a door. Hold. And then the door slowly get hit and opened. And then you listen to the grunts that Scott later recorded as the stoic, which we laid on. And then because he's lying on the floor and he's never gone anywhere, just open the door from inside. You can't see him because he's hidden by the girls in foreground. He stands as if he's just climbed up.
Fantastic.
Into silhouette and then starts to walk forward.
Amazing.
Can you see that?
Yeah. Well, I can see the trick as well. What you're saying, the trick of the camera is we don't know he's there until he's there, but it looks like he's climbed up.
Absolutely. And it comes from, you know, basically, I get the mickey taken. I work for a firm called Future Artists Entertainment a lot with Neil Jones.
Yeah.
And they go, oh, John, did you work on Brookside? Did you work on Brookside, John? Because my 5 years apprenticeship at Brookside from 1995 to 2000 was invaluable in working it out on the day if you have to.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
We're wrapping in 5 minutes. We've got to shoot a 1 minute scene. And it's like, it's a deep two and they pop back, bang, you know. And we used to shoot 30 minutes in 7 days. So that's 90 minutes in 7 days.
Yeah.
The Channel 4. So this was 90 minutes in, you know, 17, 16 days. So a luxury by some standards, but it doesn't look like Brookside. It looks like a movie. And we were very, that's why Saban and Archstone Entertainment.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
I've been able to live my normal lifestyle, and I've lost 20 pounds already. It changed my life.
I wasn't expecting it to shut off the food noise. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
And over in LA, Spahn Films, they're a £4 billion firm. And they're throwing the Stoic all over the world along with Archstone. You know, so we've got the US and Canada. I don't mean to be boastful. What I mean is...
No. It's exciting. No, it's not boastful at all. Can I ask you? You mentioned that it took you a month to write and then a couple of weeks to rewrite it, as it were. Now,
yeah.
Then you go into production and you shoot what you can, and obviously you shoot stuff that appeals to you at the time of shooting that might not have been on the page. But then when you sit down with everything in the can and you're with Scott Price, your editor, what discoveries did you make about the story that wasn't evident when you wrote it that came to the fore when you were editing it together?
The discoveries I made was, well, first of all, Scott's never cut drama, but I just had faith in him. Okay. And we knew each other by passing in the night at Granada TV 15 years ago, and I remembered him.
Okay.
From the year below me in school.
Blimey, O'Reilly.
That was a coincidence. And I did this treasure hunt for kids up in Helmshire where my girlfriend lives, and my auntie from Prestwich invited Scott and his family, not knowing he was an editor. He didn't know who I, you know, me. And his kids loved the treasure hunt and blah, 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 blah. And we were just talking, and we talked about it. And I knew you. I went, yeah, I knew you as well. And then a year later, I'm sat in his room in his house, and he's got these books on, you know, Michael Mann on editing and filmmakers. And I'm like, okay, you know, you're on my page, you're on my wavelength. So what we discovered was Scott rang me up once and he went, I've just done this effing brilliant sequence. And I was like, oh, I'm on loudspeaker. And Fiona looked at me like, the kids are in the house. I'm sorry. and he intercut two scenes, the longest scenes. But it worked so well. Okay. I was like, Scott, don't change a beat. Thank you.
Yeah.
But what I did with Scott, because we only had so much time with him, he was only about 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And he's editing from home. And he's got kids and his wife. And he needs to get out again and, you know, what have you, is... I basically let him get on with it. So I would watch sections, or he'd play me sections, and I'd go, no, that's fine, but we need that. And what I would do, what I made sure I did, was that every Friday, we're shooting in North Wales, I would drive to Manchester to Prestwich on my way home, dropping off these young fellas in our crew,
yeah,
and a car full of props and kit, as you can imagine. And the young fellas don't have cars, because so many people can't afford to drive these days, but they're talented, hardworking guys, you know. So you drop them off around Lancashire on the way back on Friday night after wrapping. And I'd drop Scott's hard driving with him. So he'd download the rushes and he'd look at it. And he'd give me, and now and again, he would say to me, just need a little cut in there. Just give me that little close up on a button being cut off, because the Stoic takes buttons as trophies and things like that. And I'm like, do you really need that close? And he went, I tell you what, you're probably right. Actually, let's just do it anyway. You know?
Yeah.
So we would find things. And there's a scene I shot, which I absolutely adore. And it was cut. He said, literally, it slows down act one, slows down the pace.
Right, okay.
And I just went, yeah, I can feel it. I can feel it. I can see it. Because I know act one inside and out. I've watched it. It's cut it. And I went, if you put that in, I get it. And the audience, they won't be bored by then, I don't think. But they, if it's going to affect their enjoyment, then just cut it. You know, the days of making films for myself, you know, I hope are well over. You know,
indeed.
You've got to make it. The audience, you're going to take what you know. So Scott was very good. Like that. He was a great advocate, and he understood the material, and he wanted to do a good job for himself. But we discovered a few things actually.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, look,
he was a good advocate. Yeah, sorry.
I was just going to say thank you for giving us that insight into the making of the Stoic. Do you want to remind people when they can see the film and how?
So it's, yes. So in the US, it begins streaming October the 18th, 2024, US and Canada. And then the UK, it is, I believe, November the 4th. You can pre-order the DVD on Amazon now. In Canada, we've got it on Apple, which is nice. But November the 4th in the UK, I've been told, so don't shoot me if this is wrong, that it's going to be on Amazon Prime. It's going to be DVD. I've seen adverts online for it for HMV. I've been told it's going to be in Asda. I'm really chuffed that they're actually producing physical DVDs for it. You know, usually with low-budget films or mid-budget films like this, they're onto streaming. So we're really, really pleased. And I'm particularly pleased because, yeah, we've got Jason Fleming, we've got Bruce Payne, we've got a great cast and what have you. But the essential thing is script. I think it all comes down to script. I'm not saying that because I wrote it, because that would be a bit distasteful. But I'm just saying that I think it's engaged people, I'm very pleased to say. And that's a tribute to every cast member and certainly every crew member.
Right. Thanks for sharing that with us about the making of The Stoic. We're now going to go into three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. Now, for the listener that hasn't heard this before, John has given me three film titles. We have got 5 minutes per film. And every time we hear this sound, you can hear that at your end, okay, John?
Yeah. So I'll be quiet on that sound. All right.
Right then, we are going to talk about a film that Ray Bradbury declared as the greatest sci-fi film ever made. I'm talking about 1977's Close Encounters. So, John, please tell us, why is this an important film to you in terms of your filmmaking and your film memories?
Why is it? I'll tell you why it's important to me. Because what the writers and what Steven Spielberg in molding it from his original idea, what they managed to do was they managed to make a story about character.
Mm-hmm.
For me. Yes, it's one man who's obsessed, so that obsession kind of almost negates the character. But it's not about, hey, here's a few people, and, whoa, wait for it, the aliens are coming, that's going to be what it's all about. And here's a glimpse, and here's a glimpse, and here's a glimpse. It's not. It's what I believe filmmaking, storytelling is all about. Story and character, story and character. Okay. For me, I'm not interested in 4K, Blu-ray, remastered, IMAX. Yeah, we all love it. I love it. But you can't remaster a bad script. You can't improve performance with, I don't care how many pixels you fire into it, you know? So for me, I don't care if watching it in 2D cinema. It's about story and character. And Close Encounters has it. And it's always meant something to me. I was actually in a job interview as a first assistant director for Noah, which was an ITV production, Noah,
right,
directed by Kenny Glenarn.
Right.
I'm going to do the job in the end. And Kenny Glenarn, Glaswegian director, great guy. And I was talking to the producer in this, you know, big posh Soho office, and she's talking about Noah. And I went, it's Close Encounters. This guy goes off into the wilderness and gets a message from a higher being, gets obsessed, goes home, negates his family, and cracks on. And then realizes physically a knowledge or an awareness which none of the rest of the world just aren't privy to. And I went, yeah, it's Roy Neary, it's Moses. I mean, he isn't Moses, and I don't wish to upset anybody who is, you know, a great subscriber to the Bible, etc. But thematically, it follows the same broad line.
Hmm.
That's what excites me, and that's what I love about Close Encounters, is that all the 1970s hysteria of UFOs and aliens. And Spielberg managed to take that, much as he was, you know, an aficionado himself, and still is, I'm sure, take that and focus it on one man's obsession, one man's journey, if you will,
mm-hmm.
on a hero's journey. And it is like, you know, it is like Joseph Campbell's Hero of a Thousand Faces, the hero's journey. He has to go through all these trials of his family don't believe him, then, you know, friends don't believe him, he gets fired from his job, then the authorities don't believe him, then does he believe himself? And eventually he finds that actually what I believed in was real, and I was right to pursue this. So as much as people can say Close Encounters is this, Close Encounters is that, for me, Close Encounters is a very strong classic story by spaceships and aliens. And I believe also it's kind of underrated in terms of Well, for me, again, look, there's various elements in it. There's the music. People can quote the famous five notes. Yeah, but I remember when I was like 7 or 8 and I had the 12-inch vinyl. In those days, you bought the vinyl of the film, and John Williams takes you on places in that score which are not known. And it is quite a haunting, scary soundtrack. And I remember I was alone in my parents' house, semi taxi in Swinton, up by Salford. And and the music was scaring me. And it took everything for me to literally pick the needle up and take it off the vinyl. And even then, it was like, that didn't really help, but at least it stopped, And that's always been the thing with Close Encounters. If you really listen to it, the soundtrack's incredible. It really gets under your
skin. Did you know that it was created before the film was edited and Spielberg edited to the music, not the other way around?
No, I didn't know that. I thought that was just Jaws.
Yeah. No, he said because it gave it a lyrical feel, which plays into what you're saying, really.
Absolutely. It does play into what I'm saying. No, absolutely, Stu. But also, if the music works, then go with the strongest element. If it's performance, the editor holds on the performance more than anything else.
Yeah.
He'll hold on one performance. If that's what brings the audience in, if it's the music, if it's a particular performance, a particular shot just held, and I want to talk about sustained music later, if you don't mind, with the films, but you hold on that element. You don't have to start cutting and chopping and, whatever works. There isn't...
Our first 5 minutes is up, John. That's your first 5 minutes, sir.
What? Blimey. Okay.
How are you feeling? Is there sweat on?
I remember when I used to box as a student, we had 3 minutes, 4 minutes on Saturday mornings doing that. And that felt shorter than that. I just went. I mean, that felt longer rather. Blimey.
Moving swiftly along and jumping into the 21st century, we're going to talk about Alexander Payne's Sideways. What is this? What is this important to you in terms of your film making and film memories?
So again, Stu, I think with Sideways, what I thought I'd do is I'd find a theme, at least between Close Encounters and Sideways, just because it's quite a compact show and I wanted to keep it compact to an extent. Sideways is about characterist story. It's an old taught screenplay adage, the character is story. Your character is the story, their motivations, what they learn, Luke Skywalker, you name it, okay? You look at screenplay by Sid Field, Robert McKee, story. Save the Cat by Blake Snyder, Adventure in the Screen Trade, William Goldman. They might not say it, but to me, having read all those books 20 times, they kind of subscribe to it.
Yeah.
Sideways is a great film. It's also a great film of world building. We had Jack and Miles, who used to be college roommates, two middle-aged guys, one's a failing writer or a frustrated writer, one's a frustrated actor. We all have these relationships with similar people, or we are those people.
Yeah.
They lie to each other all the time. These guys, we get to see their lies to each other. We get to watch this relationship with these two guys where they forgive each other's lies. We've known each other 30, 40 years, these characters. They go on a wine tasting week where old Jack wants to do the actors meet women and Miles just wants to chill out, have some wine. Jack's getting married. So it's kind of a bachelor week. They're going to California wine tasting country where me and a friend, production designer Debbie Burton, actually shot through in a car once before I was a father, but went out of money. And we came across Solvang and Bolton where they shot the film, which I did not expect. So you can imagine how I was like, what? And I sat at the bar where Miles sat and everything.
Oh, amazing.
But the thing is, it turned me on to Alexander Payne. And I just find his style incredible. I find the way he lets the actors really go into character. And I don't just mean like, explore the character. I mean, really find a character with him. You can tell these people work together. It's based on a great book by Rex Pickett. I've actually got the soundtrack poster and book of this. And when I read the book, coincidentally, on the plane over to California in 2008, whenever we went, just coincidentally, I didn't expect to come across the place where they shot it. Rex Pickett's book is fantastic. There's only one small chapter that isn't in the film. It's
worth reading
the film. Yeah, it really is. And I find that the film, even though I read the book, like a book in the way that you get into the character, the way that the author might talk in the first or third person, but you really get into these characters, you really see them thinking. And it's something that we don't do enough of in Britain, is I've c- come up through British TV, and I felt frustrated that we worship the word. Everyone's going to be talking all the time. Sopranos, The Wire, they have characters thinking. Mm. And I think in the Stoic, Rocky, Boy Williams and Scott Wright's characters, I have them thinking, the good guy and the bad guy. And it aids their arcs. And the Americans do it a lot. We'll sit down with Tony Soprano, we'll watch him think, and we deliberate with him, you know, or Idris Elba in The Wire. And it's something that happens in Sideways where these characters, they're best friends. One of them just wants to chase women. One of them wants to follow the wine. One of them, you know, is a connoisseur. And you watch them watching each other lie and outdo each other and outsmart each other and bicker. And it's just brilliant. It's not like a play where it's just actors talking. It is just great. It's the subtext of everything. And I think the reason it's character is story is because there is no story without those characters doing something.
Mm.
So whether it's Jack hitting on the waitress and then Miles being disapproving of that, which causes, you know, friction, without them doing something, there is no story. It's not like, oh, up there, the bad guys are building a big space station. So whatever we do, that's still happening. It's like, no, there's nothing happening without these guys actually motivating it. And it's world building. You've got California, you've got these people who live kind of middle-class lives, but one, you know, the waitress, struggling teacher slash writer, unemployed actor mostly. But they live in this wine, cheese, socially sophisticated environment, and they have common language. And it builds a world of these people.
Mm, absolutely.
I found it works. I was a waiter in Florida when I was a student for 3 or 4 months. And you find that unlike here, people who do service industry are not looked at, you know, jobs are not looked down upon necessarily like they are in Europe, maybe. Mm. They're not so in the States. And these, you know, the interesting, educated people, and there's no shame, as there shouldn't be. There's no stigma in doing those jobs. And that's why I love Sideways, is that Maya is the heroine, really, for want of a better word, is a waitress. But it's just, she doesn't act a waitress, you know?
Finish your thought, go on.
Thank you. She doesn't act the waitress like you would write a waitress anywhere. She is an incredible character, and she's the strongest character. You know, she's the lifeboat that Miles needs.
Yeah.
And she's a highly educated woman, really sophisticated character. And the film just looks past the fact she's a waitress. It's just a device for our heroes to meet her, you know? And that's what I love about it. It's a world, it's a societal attitude in Sideways as well.
Mm.
And the whole film's have a lot of fun.
Indeed, yeah. It is. Right then, we're going to subvert the rule for your third choice. We've got two titles you've given me for your third choice. We've got personally one of my favourite films, Sicario, by De Villeneuve, Taylor Sheridan's wonderful screenplay and his debut screenplay at that, and Peter Weir's Witness from. So we've got 2015 versus 1985. But why have you put them together? What do they represent for you?
The reason I put them together is they both sustain attention like a musical note, like a tuning fork for me. They both feel the same. So both because of their music, both because of their performances, the characters just think and stare and you are forced to watch them. Peter Weir's brilliant at getting you into character, whether it's Dead Poets or it's Witness.
Mm.
He brings you don't just watch actors acting, you're in with them. You're in with them, you know. I think his style is a bit more objective in Gallipoli, but not so much, certainly not in Witness. And I think Sicario uses every piece. I mean, look, you've got Johan Johansson's music. It's directed by Denis Villeneuve. You've got Roger Deakins shooting it to Taylor Sheridan's screenplay. Sicario, how can you not love it? How can you go wrong and you don't? Everything I respect and have grown to get excited about with filmmaking is perfectly pitched in Sicario. And in terms of the writing, people say, oh, and it's amazing because they switch from Emily Blunt's character to Benicio Del Toro's character. Well, actually, no, in preparation for this, I looked at that. They do. But Del Toro's only like the penultimate 15, 20 minutes. Then you're back to Blunt at the end.
Mm.
And it doesn't matter that they do that. And you don't have to go, oh, they've subverted the discipline of writing. No, come on. Don't calm down. It's just the story, it just takes you there effortlessly.
Mm.
And it's fine, you know. And I think There's
I think, I don't know about you, but I think Emily Blunt is like our eyes and ears. That's her character. It is very different from the usual protagonist, because I know he has the hero's journey, as it were, but I feel like Emily Blunt is, because we don't understand this world unless we're here being the person that doesn't understand it. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. She's the empty vessel through which we see everything.
Yeah.
As is, to an extent, Book. I mean, I know Harrison Ford deservedly was Oscar nominated and witness for that, but they're the empty vessel through which we view these worlds.
Exactly, yeah.
And they both have themes. Like Book, for me, in Witness, is, I watched it the other day just to prepare myself for this, and guess what? I don't own the DVD. It's lived with me so much that I thought I owned the DVD. I've never had it, never bought it. It's just stayed in my heart and mind for, amazing, you know, 5 years, whatever it is. But you've got, actually, it's long, more than that. Both of them, she's got the theme of family. She's a lone woman, no children, divorced. He has no family. He gets to visit the family he never has. She gets to kind of like discuss family and think about it. And in the end, she realizes her purpose wasn't her purpose. And he gets to realize, what is my purpose? I'm a cop. I don't have wife and kids. I've been given a taste of wife and kids. She's been given a taste of, you need to get on with your own life as well as your career, as we all do, not just women, I'm talking about people in general. And I think that those are really interesting themes within those technically brilliant films.
Mm.
And I noticed another thing watching it the other night was when a great scene when young Lucas Haas, the boy, identifies McPhee, Danny Glover, in a press cutting framed in a trophy cabinet. And it reminded me of Peter Weir's Dead Poets Society, same director, whereby he gets the boys to look at the framed rugby and team pictures on right. The wall of the school, and he whispers, "Seize the day, boys." And they're just mesmerized by these extreme close-ups, probably blew up the image, you know,
of
these dead boys, of these objects. They're the objects of the theme. Seize the day, suck the marrow from your life. And in Witness, this is our pursuit, this is our lost ark, is this guy. You know, this is the corrupt cop.
Yeah.
And he uses the same thing where people silently or with very little sound are just looking through into cabinets or through glass at black and white, crudely printed images of these characters. I was kind of like, you've used the same trope, Mr. Weir. I mean, he's passed away now, but what a brilliant trope, and how superbly well done in both instances, you know. And I loved, Ford's a very physical actor. When you watch him, he is physical and the whole thing. But I believed him as a cop, as a policeman. I believed him as a guy burying himself in his job. I love his relationship with his sister, which is only in two or three scenes, where he cares about them, he oversees them.
Finish your thought.
Contempt, you know. And there's contempt in all the relationships in Witness. Mm. It's so well written. Nobody gets a free ride. No character gets a free ride in it.
Thank you very much for sharing those thoughts on those three films, Close Encounters, Sideways, Sicario, plus Witness. And thank you very much for being on the podcast.
Well, Stu, it's been an absolute pleasure, I must say. And thank you for the introduction of limiting my thoughts on films to 5 minutes. I don't think anybody's successfully done that, apart from my girlfriend Fiona, of course, who limits it to 5 seconds. But yeah, thank you so much.